An object in motion stays in motion until a larger or opposing
force
will stop it, or greater than will stop it. And so I kind of lived by that. I thought getting hepatitis was that force that was going to stop me, and it didn't. So I just kind of spun out of control, and then I realized in treatment that I was the force that could stop myself from going out of control. Hello, and welcome to Diary of a Former Addict. I am your host, Ellen.
And I'm Annie.
And today we are going to be talking about what brought us to recovery. So a warning for the listeners out there that they might find some things triggering, or they might hear some sexual or adult language. So listener beware. That's what I say.
Yes.
So we're going to kick things off, I guess, with my story. I think it's important that we share our stories of substance use disorder and recovery, because while they might not be unique to many people out there, but they can be helpful for a lot of people. And they'll find similarities and commonalities among our stories that help them to relate and or help see that they can too go to recovery and make it through and come out the other end a much healthier person. So that being said, where should we start? I mean, where should we start? Should we just start at the beginning?
I mean, that's always the best place to start.
You know, Julie
Andrews once said, "If you listen to the sound of music, we both have the same thing."
It was really funny. I was watching this TikTok video, and this this one creator was, first of all, we'll talk about TikTok here in a second, but I still don't get it. I did a lot of drugs during the whole TikTok craze, so I'm still learning. But anyway, I was watching this one creator, and he's so funny. He's like saying that I just want to put a video out there for us all to get to know each other a little better. And so, yeah, so he's like, it all started at the beginning with that moment, and that's how it happened. And I hope all of you out there can relate. It's like, you know, it was a funny video, but in a way it was kind of like, oh, that's like a really cute little way of saying that, like, we all have similar instances in our lives that lead us to certain situations.
Yeah.
You know, he was being funny about it. I don't think he really intended for me to find some meaning in that, but you never know.
Maybe he did.
So I guess where we should start is I should start with, what led me to my substance use disorder? And I guess it's very hard for me to pinpoint a reason or a feeling or a specific trauma moment, because up to the point of using, I led a pretty dull life. Well, I wasn't dull life. I had a lot of things going on.
I was going to say.
It was, looking at my life from the outside in, you would never expect me to be somebody who would become a drug addict. Right. And I say that in the nicest way possible without sounding arrogant or like I'm being judgmental, because there is no standard for what a drug addict looks like or who is, because it is a disease that knows no socioeconomic background or anything like that. You know, I was married. I had been married for a couple years at this point. We were together for a while since college. And I still owned the hair salon at this point, and I was in grad school, and I was directing shows for the community theater. So, you know, I had a lot of things happening, a lot of things going on, and I was very content with the other projects I had in my life, not specifically with, like, my marriage. It was not a very happy marriage, which will surprise a lot of people who knew us, but I feel like if you knew me, you could tell that I was happiest when I was in the theater, or yep. I was happiest when I was at the salon. But at home, I wasn't too thrilled with my marriage. A precursor to this is that my ex-husband was in a very serious car accident, was in a coma for 18 days, total of 11 months in the hospital. It was a very, very hard time. And it took a huge toll on me, both mentally and physically. Mm-hmm. And because of his injuries, I don't think he ever really, and to this day, I still don't think he understands all that I went through because of his memory loss and because of, you know, being in a coma, he didn't really remember. It was hard on me because I felt like I was doing a thankless job. And that sounds shitty coming out of my mouth.
No, it sounds normal.
But, you know, I felt unloved. I felt unwanted. I felt undesirable because he had lost a lot of weight while he was in the coma. Suddenly, now I didn't fit his idea. And there were backhanded comments about, you know, how I shouldn't wear certain clothes. He would often say, you know, I remember after a show that I had spent weeks on, well, months, really, because of all the preparation beforehand, it was Steel Magnolias. And at opening night, somebody had given me a compliment, and he said, oh, don't give him a compliment. His head's already big enough. His ego will barely fit out the door.
Oh.
And I was like, that was like the first moment where I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I can't even, you know, accept compliments anymore for hard work that I had done. And so that kind of shut me down to where I just wasn't proud. I was proud of my accomplishments, but I was never openly proud about it. And that's something that has changed now, that when I have accomplished something, you better believe I'm praising myself. If nobody else is going to, I'm going to.
Right, you got to celebrate.
Right, you got to celebrate life, celebrate it all. But anyway, so in my life, in my world prior to drugs, I lived in a world where I couldn't succeed, where I wouldn't allow myself to succeed. And what do I mean by that? Well, I'll tell you. When I was in my final residency for grad school, this was our thesis presentations, and I went to grad school to be a playwright. And so my thesis play was given to a literary critic or a literary supervisor for a local theater in the Pittsburgh area, a pretty big, prominent theater in the Pittsburgh area. And this person, I can still remember their name, they basically gave me a review that said I shouldn't be a playwright.
Ugh.
And so I instantly went into destroy it all mode, because what have the last 2 years been in my life? Mm-hmm. Why am I pursuing this? I'm just stupid. I don't know what I'm doing. This is ridiculous for me to ever think that I could be a famous playwright. So I did what I typically do. And back in those days, when I wanted to be destructive, I either spent a lot of money. I had very unsafe sexual encounters. You know, I kind of fell back into those habits. Which,
those habits are pretty cool. Addiction.
Right. And you and I were talking before about the dual diagnosis. And really, this was the beginning signs of personality disorder, borderline personality disorder. This sort of destroy everything that I've tried to create before anybody else can destroy it type of situation.
Right.
I was invited to a hotel party. Now, also, I've always had body image issues. And at this point in my life, I think I was at like 190 maybe is what I weighed. And at my heaviest, whenever my ex-husband was in the hospital, I was about 240, maybe 230, about that weight. And so like I had resorted to diet pills and over-the-counter weight loss medicine, like everything I could possibly get to lose weight fat, because there's that instant gratification that I was looking for. So to self-soothe this time, this night, I found a hotel party. Now, up to this too, being a boy from the country, I had no idea what Tina was. I had no clue. I had no idea what GHB was. I had, up to this point, maybe just done weed and drank. That was it.
Yeah.
So I get to this party and they're like, oh, do you want to try some Tina? I'm like, I don't know what that is, so sure. And I wish I could really go back, because I do remember this moment of standing at the hotel door and thinking to myself, should I do this? There was a second before I knocked on the door, and I wish I could go back and just be like, nah, turn yourself around and just walk back to your room.
Yeah.
But I didn't, you know, as fate, there's a reason that I was there, supposed to be there, and there was a reason for everything. And looking back, I see it now. But at the time, and even to this day, I still wish I could go back and change it. But we cannot rewrite history.
No.
But, you know, that night, though, I was so wanting somebody to just make me feel good, to not make me feel like I had wasted my life, to make me feel desired, wanted, and to be in that moment. So the thing is, and this goes back to the very first episode when we talked about stigma, the people that were at this party were not the typical people that I would have in my mind as people who do meth.
Right.
I mean, the man hosting the party was a really well-to-do lawyer from Washington, D.C. There were nurses, doctors, teachers, you know, all kinds of people in this room that I looked around and I never even thought that Tina could be another word for meth, because they're not what I thought of when I thought of the word meth.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I thought Tina was just a party drug like ecstasy or right. MDMA or something like that, you know.
That, yeah.
But whatever it was, is I knew from that moment I felt good. And then that night I felt great. But what I wasn't prepared for was the next day, whenever, like you said, that dopamine drops back down and you're just depressed and you're tired and, you know, you feel guilt and shame for what you did. And so then you just seek it out again because it just takes you right back up again. So that's what brought me to use. And we said too before that, like, a lot of times being an addict isn't so much a question of what, but a question of when.
Yeah.
Because for me, I come from a long line of alcoholics. My grandfather's an alcoholic. My dad would be classified an alcoholic, I guess, but I wouldn't really classify him as that because he doesn't have any of the standard typical behaviors of an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, the man does like to drink his beer, but he's never been abusive. He's never been violent. He's never been unsafe. You know, so it's really, I guess, an argument of, is there such a thing as a functioning alcoholic?
Not really.
Is there such a thing as a functioning addict?
No. I mean, that's just my opinion. But, like, what's the definition of functioning?
See, that's because, I mean, like, I was a functioning addict for a while until I wasn't. You know?
I've heard that a lot of times. Like, I still had a job and I was making money and I was going to work. And, you know, right. Literally your brain was not functioning in the way right. that it should, because it kept taking you back to that substance.
I still have a different idea or a different timeline in my head about when I felt I was out of control, as opposed mm-hmm. to whenever people saw me getting out of control.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Well, yeah. Okay.
So it's very hard for me to sort of timeline the series of events that happened after that first sort of use, because I don't remember a lot. And it all sort of seemed like what 6 years was in my mind is that it only took place in a year. So it's a very condensed version of what happened. And a lot happened. Whew, a lot happened. So, all right. Here
I think
we go.
I've just had some stuff that popped in my head, like you just saying that what happened over a period of 6 years seemed like it was only a year. Like it went by so fast. That happens a lot in addiction where we just lose time. You lose time.
We lose time. And then we sit here and we think to ourselves, God, 28 days seems like so long.
Right.
Or, you know, and it's like, really?
Or 90 even.
Right. It's not. It's not a long time in the retrospect of the years that you spent running, or in relation to the years that you spent running. It's not a long time for you to be sober.
It's not a long time for you to put into recovery.
Right. That's what I was trying to say. Thank you. After that first, I spent some time sober because I was still living in the small town just north of Pittsburgh. And I do regret being the one to introduce my ex to it. That being said, I can have that regret, but I am not the one who chose his life after that.
Right. That's also really healthy say.
Yeah, he went deep and dark and I tried to warn him. I told, you know, he wanted to start selling and dealing. And I said, absolutely not. I was like, you're going to get caught. And I flat out told him, like, you're just not smart enough to do it. And, I mean, I wasn't wrong. For those out there, there are spoilers ahead, just so you know. Cut to moving to Pittsburgh. And moving to Pittsburgh, I thought was going to be a very good move for me. I thought it was going to be a lateral move. I thought it was going to be a chance for me to kind of start over again and to focus on my artistic endeavors. And for the first, like, 6 or 8 months, it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I entered into the Pittsburgh Fringe Festival. I put my play up. I won Best Writing for that,
which is awesome.
It was, and I thought it was a big deal. And then, of course, there comes my ex to bring me back down again.
Mm.
You know, my ex always had a problem with, and I'm gonna brag for a second, but when I do something and I put my whole mind to it, I do it very well. And you do. He couldn't understand that. And we actually got into a fight one night. I was getting ready for a show. This is whenever I started doing drag as well. And in my drag career went pretty quick for somebody who just started out. I mean, I only did maybe like one open stage before I was getting booked consistently every weekend. And then finally, you know, within like the first 6 months of doing drag, I have my own show once a month at a bar. Wow. And so, you know, like it went quick, but that's because I was good at it.
Yeah.
I was funny. You know, I started doing stand-up with it. And so I did something different. And so that got me into these hosting jobs that eventually led me into having my own show. And that was back whenever I was still, like, I wasn't too far into my youth. And I was able to, you know, create costumes and do looks and be a responsible performer because, you know, I haven't quite given over everything yet. Or I hadn't quite given up full control to the drug yet. But I was getting ready for a show, and I asked him, I straight up asked him, I said, are you jealous of me? And he said, yes. He's like, I don't understand why you're just good at everything you do. And I'm like, okay. Like, I don't know. Like, how do you process that?
I couldn't even tell you. You know?
It's like, it's not like I'm choosing things that I know I'm not good at. Like, I'm not going to be a biochemist. Because I know I'm not going to be good at being a biochemist. Like, I know I'm good at performing, so I'm going to perform. I know I'm good at directing, I'm going to direct. I'm good at doing hair, I'm going to do hair. You know, I don't go outside of my wheelhouse.
Right.
It doesn't mean I don't challenge myself in those careers, because I do, and I did. It just means that I don't go outside of what I know my skill set is. You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Nope.
And I think that was always the problem, is that he had delusions of grandeur. And I always had delusions of simplicity. I wanted to be famous. I wanted to be rich and famous and do all that stuff. But really, in the back of my mind, I've always just wanted a nice, simple life to be able to afford what I can afford and live on.
Yep.
Really, I just want to hit the lottery or, like, marry rich is really what I was going for. So after that, I mean, he and I, we had a lot of problems. And the drug use didn't help. You know, it went from being just like once in a while to every weekend to we promised it would just be on the weekends. Then it started drifting into the weekday. And then it's like, you know, we'd get a little out of control. And I'd say, no, we need to go back to just the weekends. And then it took control and it took over. I mean, he went to jail. And when he got out, I was so delusional that I knew he couldn't move back into the apartment with me because that would have been a bad idea. But I still helped him get a hotel room that night that he got out. I helped him find a place to live, and I gave him custody of the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was a lot of things that were said that he said about me to the people in the city, and a lot of people stopped talking to me because of it, and a lot of people stopped being my friend because of the things he said. And so what followed was a very lonely 2 or 3 years of just being alone. And abruptly being alone too. It wasn't like it was an ease into it. It was like I had to find a whole new set of friends. I had to find, you know, a new life for myself, really. And I found it in the drug world, because in the party world, there's a very close-knit group of people that you know are always going to be there. But
for all the wrong reasons.
Right. I was going to say, but here's the catch. Once the money goes and once the drugs go, they go too. So when I lost my job, and I was on the verge of eviction from my apartment, all of a sudden, I was alone again. Because here's the thing about drug addicts is that they don't like to be around people that remind them of where their life is going. You know, nobody wants the party to stop because so-and-so is about to lose his job and so-and-so has no money left and so-and-so is going to get evicted and be homeless. We don't want that as a reminder of where our lives are going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody wants to deal with the reality, which is why we do drugs. Again, you know, I'm alone, and I had let a fellow performer from the drag bar move in with me. We got into an argument, a really big fight, and I don't even remember about what, really. And then the bar owner had told me that my friend was not going to be allowed to perform that night in the show because of, I don't even know anymore. And so I was just doing what I was told, and then it came back and backfired on me. And my friend had apparently had videos of like my party supplies that were locked up in my room. and they showed them to the owner. And then I was asked to step down to get help, but I would be allowed back, you know, was the premise of which I would step down as the show director. Well, that didn't happen. I have no job. I have no money. I have no home. I have no friends. I have no show. I was living in my car for maybe about like a week. Like, it wasn't a very long time. But then I had a friend who had an apartment and a room for rent, and he said that I could live there, which I will forever be grateful for. I mean, that I can't even explain how grateful I was for that person. And that's where I lived for the last, 2 years. Like I said, it's hard for me to figure out exactly how many years it's been, because, and in the middle of that too, now we have COVID. So I've been quarantined.
Which has been rough on everybody.
Right. And so the highlights that have happened in between there, I guess, is where we should go next. Like, what the drugs led me to do that I would never do as a sober person. I've never been a very sexual person. Even before the drugs, like, I could have sex maybe like once a year and be fine with that. Mm-hmm. It's a disposition of the Aquarian. We can take it or leave it.
I'm the complete opposite of that.
I found that I was seeking my self-worth in my sexual partners and sexual encounters.
Yeah.
Because I was losing weight.
That connection becomes an addiction too.
Was losing weight, I was looking good, people were noticing me, and I liked the attention. I loved the attention. I remember the first person I met after my ex that I thought I could love, and I had it so wrong. And that broke my heart even more, and so that put me into a little bit more of a depression. But then what it did was it really hardened me to the cold reality of not just the gay party scene, but the gay hookup culture in general.
Mm-hmm.
I became very, very disenchanted with the gay community and the way that they treat other people. It's very, very, very toxic. The whole community is very toxic. And for those listening who don't agree with me, have you ever been on Grindr before ever in your life? Because it is the most, it's like Yelp for gays. It's just like, it's awful.
Wow.
It's terrible. But then I started to become one of those people because I had lost a lot of weight. I had a six pack. I had this really nice chest. I have, you know, I'm a very well endowed man. So like I had all the makings of it, and I became the people I didn't like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was because the drugs gave me that sort of undeserved confidence.
Right.
You know, it's like I had a God complex almost. You know, I started doing amateur pornography. I did camming online with people. And that's sort of how I got a little bit of fame in the party scene, and the sex scene.
Mm-hmm.
The sex industry, it afforded me the ability to go to Seattle, to LA, Palm Springs, Nashville, Atlanta, Columbus, Washington, D.C., you know, and I would go there and not know anybody, and like we'd be hanging out, and then they would say, oh, you're so-and-so from Zoom, or you're so-and-so from Twitter.
Wow.
And then they would, you know, and that, like, at the time, made me feel good. There are still times whenever people would say things, like, that are very inappropriate, for this podcast to me, but I would be like, oh, thank you. but like, even till today, like today, I just had somebody message me from 3 years ago or so wanting to know if I wanted to hang out. And I said, no. And he lives in Buffalo, but he drove down to see me. It's like, come on, people. I'm not that great, but I'm pretty great.
I think you're pretty great, but for other reasons.
Right. So like, you know, I kind of got into this sort of this really dark sort of underbelly of, I don't know how I avoided being arrested because I did some stupid, stupid things. I remember one time I was driving home from a client's house who lived 45 minutes away from me. I had taken GHB and it started to hit me as I was driving. And
Alan,
I had to pull over at a McDonald's. Apparently I fell asleep because a police officer knocked on the window, which incited a panic attack. And I told him I was having a panic attack and I'll be fine. I just need to like calm down. And he left me. He left. I don't know how
Oh, wow.
Or why. And I don't know how I made it home. I mean, I drove without a headlight. I had no inspection. I had no registration for my car. I mean, I chanced it every single time I left my apartment. And it became a strain on my new roommate because I'd have people over all the time. I didn't care. I just wanted to feel good and not alone. And that's really what has been the hardest for me in recovery is being alone and learning to be okay with that.
So I have a question for you.
Yes.
So you were alone, but were there people that you were just ashamed to be around? So your perception was that you were alone, but you didn't reach out to the people you knew would be there for you.
Right. Right, because I was ashamed of the drugs. Like, okay. I was embarrassed
for which happens abuse,
which you stand at the center of your addiction and you look around a circle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like, it's like this, a scene in the movie where you're moving in slow motion, but everybody else is moving around you. That's kind of like how the world was for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, there are these people that are at the peripheral of the circle that are looking in, and these are the people that have always been there. But yet, I didn't feel that I could go to them because I didn't want to be judged for my use.
So were you surprised in your recovery that those people didn't judge you?
No, because I always knew that they didn't really judge me, but I had projected that onto them.
Yeah.
I projected my own guilt onto those people. Yeah. So in a clear-headed state of mind, I was able to understand that those people have always been there and never would have judged. But also at the same time, I didn't want to stop.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, mm-hmm. I didn't want to involve people that would want me to stop because I didn't want to stop. And I didn't want to have to lie to anybody.
You're telling people right now that are listening to this is an honest depiction of many people who have addiction.
It's true. And that's the thing, is that people will want the addict to stop what they're doing, but you can't force them to stop.
No.
That's only going to cause a relapse. They might go to treatment for a couple weeks. They might go see, you know, a counselor. Like I did. I mean, I did the bare minimum to appease a lot of people, but I didn't stop.
Right.
And so cut to 2 summers ago now, would have been, I was diagnosed with hepatitis A. I was very sick when I came back from DC from a trip, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. The drugs made me sick. As soon as I would shoot up, I would vomit. I couldn't, like, the GHB made me want to throw up. Everything was making me sick. Even food was making me sick at this point. And so after about 4 days of being sick, I had my roommate call an ambulance to come get me, and the ambulance took me to the hospital, and that's when I found out I had hepatitis. And so that prompted me to get sober for like 3 weeks, I think was about the total I was sober. And in that time, I started the little journal, like the video vlog that I had prior to Diary of a Former Addict. I had Diary of a Former Party Boy.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, and I would do like little videos. Well, somebody had made a comment that was very upsetting, and then that person came to personally attack me through direct messaging.
Oh wow.
And looking back on it now, I understand it was a projection of their own failure that they were coming at me with, as opposed mm-hmm. to any sort of like real malice. Although there probably was some malice to it, but at this point in my life,
people treat other people is a reflection of themselves.
Yeah, that person really has no matter or say or power in my life anymore. So it doesn't really matter. But at the time, it was somebody who did have a little bit of weight in my world. And so that prompted a relapse. I did the stupid thing and didn't throw all of my supplies away whenever I got out of the hospital. And so I did what was called a blood slam, which is where you take all of the blood out of the old points and you create a new slam out of it. So you're basically injecting yourself with old blood,
yeah,
which is so dangerous.
Very.
Because you have no idea what you're actually injecting into yourself. I could have been injecting hepatitis right back into my body, basically.
Yeah.
And so that's when I got that hit, and I felt that little bit of a rush, and I said, I want more. I want more. I just don't want to deal with having to face what this person is saying about me. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not ready to face it and I can't do it alone. I also thought I could do the whole sobriety thing alone for that time as well. Cut to then that fall, and I am in a situation where I was coming down from GHB, and I was at a friend's house, or so I thought, a friend's house, and I was assaulted. And luckily I was of enough sound mind to know that I needed to leave the situation because it was going to get worse. But I had no way to leave the situation. I didn't have a car. They said that they would get me an Uber home. They weren't getting me an Uber home now because I wanted to leave early. And so I ended up having to walk about 3 miles in the outskirts of Pittsburgh. So I'm like in the Hill District, Hill area, not the Hill District.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the South Hills or Penn Hills. I was in Penn Hills area. And so it's all uphill. I had no idea where I was going. My phone was dead, of course. And so I crying. It's wee hours of the morning. People are going to work. I finally found like a Dollar General. I'm trying to call the person who had my car to see if they would come get me. And they said they couldn't. Then I didn't know what else to do. And so I called one of my really good friends from college. And she came and got me. And I couldn't talk to her about what had happened because I was so embarrassed. But that's basically when I just said to everybody, like, I relapsed and I'm not going back right now. Like, this is it. I'm just done with everybody. And then that's when I started the traveling, because I found that if I traveled and people in the city didn't see me on Grindr, then I had some leeway of saying that, oh, I'm doing better because I'm traveling and I'm not, you know, getting high anymore.
Right.
But I was doing it just elsewhere.
Yeah.
And so it became one of those things where it's like, I still was living in a world where I couldn't succeed. I still was living in a world where I pretended like I didn't care what other people thought of me. I was treating people just awful. Because like I said, after that heartbreak, I mean, I became so hardened to emotions that I wouldn't allow myself to feel emotions. So like, yeah. I didn't date anybody. I really haven't dated anybody since my ex and I split up, because I haven't cared about another person enough to want to date them. And I know that sounds kind of shitty.
It doesn't.
It's an honest program.
It literally does not sound shitty, though, like, because that goes back to where you're talking about the difference between self-centeredness, and you've got to be self-centered right now.
You know, I was at the point now, after that incident where I was assaulted, I basically became a zombie. I would get so G'd out and pass out and just let people do whatever they wanted to me. I just didn't care. You know, and the more people, the better, because I didn't want to be alone, especially when I was on these trips. Like, I never wanted to be alone. And I fell in and out of G-love with people, and you know, the paranoia would get to me at some points. And I was just tired. My last run was in Atlanta, and I was only there, supposed to be there for 3 days. I ended up being there for almost 2.5 weeks. And when I came home from that run, I was just like, I'm just tired. And then that's what led me to rehab. It would take 2 rehabs before I would actually, you know, get my shit together. But I mean, this is the life of the addict. I mean, we, not anymore, but we'll go until, you know, I used to say that, like, the only way that I would stop using is as a, what was it? I'd use like Pythagorean's theorem, not Pythagorean, but, Newton. An object in motion stays in motion until a larger or opposing
force
will stop it. Well, greater than will stop it. And so I kind of lived by that. I thought getting hepatitis was that force that was going to stop me, and it didn't. So I just kind of spun out of control. And then I realized in treatment that I was the force that could stop myself from going out of control.
Mm-hmm. That's where the difference comes.
That's always hard for people to realize. And I feel for addicts out there who don't feel like they have any other options. I feel for people who don't feel that they're strong enough, or that they just can't do it, because I felt that way too. I felt that way a lot. I felt that way this week. You know, I felt that way. You know, it's just, we all feel that way at some point, but we just have to keep reminding ourselves that we are stronger and we are worthy of living a better life. I look back and I try to think to myself, well, what were some of those like micro traumas that may have led me to drug use? But, and really it just came down to the fact that my greatest fear was to be alone. I always was somebody who made sure that everything was copacetic with everybody so that nobody got mad and nobody left. And I don't know where that exactly came from, because my parents are still together. My parents have been married for almost 40 years.
But you have had loss in your life.
And there was my grandmother got sick, and I just couldn't deal with her not being in my life, and my drug use that's pretty much whenever it started to pick up. And like I said, like there's things that came along the way that you're just gonna have to wait for the memoir to really know about. So, you know, be checking your bookshelves next year. Oh God, I wish if I could get a book deal.
That would be awesome.
Any publishers out there who would like the first go at.
Can I do your book cover art?
Of course.
I would paint for you or something.
Like, what I want to say is about, like, my story in particular is that there are things I did that I wish I had done differently. You but I don't.
Many other people.
Yeah, I don't regret it anymore, though.
Good.
Because I feel regret is a wasted emotion.
It is.
It's just to dig you into a deeper hole of depression. The reason I can say I don't regret it is because I know I'm not going to do it again right now in my life. And I say right now in my life because we can never make promises or guarantees.
Nope.
And that was the thing about the first time I relapsed. I felt so much guilt and shame because I was so public about my sobriety that I didn't know how to just pick up and move on.
Yeah.
Instead, I just kept doing. I think the other important thing out there to say is that, you know, I'm not giving myself permission to relapse in the future, but I'm not going to beat myself up if it happens.
Corny as it sounds, everybody says it. Relapse is a part of recovery.
It really is. In most cases, from what I have read, a lot of people learn more from their relapse than they do from their time they spent sober.
Yep.
Like I said, I'm not giving myself permission to do it today or tomorrow or whatever, but I am prepared for a moment that there may come a moment when I will relapse. That is a constant fear of the addict in recovery, because we don't want to, but we also know that we are weak individuals still. No matter how strong we portray ourselves, that we are still weak.
Recovery is a lifelong process.
It is. It is. And so,
you know, the other thing is, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just feel like a lot of families need to understand that. A lot of people who are, someone who loves someone with substance use disorder, need to understand that just because someone goes to rehab once, that doesn't mean they get cured.
Right. And that's what I was going to say, too. And that's what those that are still on the outside of that ring looking in, if a loved one ever relapses, do not make them feel worse about it. Because I can guarantee you the guilt and shame they have from relapsing, especially if they have like months or years under their belt, is way worse than any sort of guilt or shame that you could put on them for relapse.
Yep. Absolutely.
You know, and I had actually, somebody had called me, a friend that I had made here where I live now. And they said, you know, my friend relapsed and I just don't know what to do. Like, what should I say? And I said, well, here's the thing. I was like, you can say, call me if you're going to use. But the thing is that at that point, the addict has already decided to use, you know, because we're all or nothing people. We either use or we don't. And I explained that to him and I said, all you have to do is just be there and be normal. The worst thing for me was whenever people would be like, well, here's a number for a treatment center. Here's this, here's that. It's like, no, I don't want that kind of help right now. I just want you to help me feel normal, you know, like help me feel normal again. Don't make me feel worse about what I did because I already feel guilty about it. Help me.
You just need someone to sit in the room with you while you cry.
Right. Or, you know, just sit with me while I come down. Just sit here while I come down, at least. No matter how crazy I might get, just please just be here, because if there's somebody normal here, you know, it'll be easier for me not to relapse further. Being understanding and knowing how both sides of the coin flip, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes sense. When I do the family stuff, you know, for family groups and stuff, I try to hit home that it's also important to know that you're not the person who's going to cure them. It's not your responsibility, and there is no cure. And it's not your responsibility to be finding them all these different, like, rehabs and stuff.
I've been sober for a few days at this point. You know, I'm living in the recovery house. I'm going to meetings. And I had this one in particular week where it was just felt like no matter what I do, I always end up in the same situations financially or whatever. But I end up in these spots where I just can't take care of myself. Mm-hmm. And I was getting tired of it. And I'm just like, when is it my turn? When is it going to be my fucking turn to finally be able to, you know, live on my own or to have a car or to, you know, da 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 da, A, B, C, D, whatever. Mm-hmm. And up to this point, I also hadn't started working yet. It was just like one thing after another to get to work or to start working. And my entire life at this point was revolved around recovery. So it was meetings, it was podcasts, it was counselors, it was this, and that. And it all had to do with recovery. And it almost consumed my entire life. And then it got to a point where I'm having drug dreams again about using, and I'm just praying to God I don't wake up before the rush. You know, I just want to feel the rush in my dream before I wake up, because that is the only way I'm going to get high anymore. I was so low, so low. And I was at a meeting and I said to them, I was like, look, I was like, I dream about the doll life, the waking up every day at the same time, going to the gym, going to work, coming home at the same time, cooking dinner, going to bed, waking up and repeating it for the rest of my life. I dream about that. It sounds so utterly boring and I love it. But same. The thing is about the person in that life versus the person in this life, I may stay sober, but I will always have the craving.
Yeah.
And the person in that alternate life, they never took the first, so they never have to wake up wondering what it felt like. Every single day, I go about my normal day, but I'm also fighting cravings and I'm fighting desires. And yes, yeah, so the cravings and desires every day get a little less and less and less, but no matter what, I'm always going to have that in the back of my mind, because that is something that you just don't forget.
Yep.
And so that's the thing to remember, listeners, is that no matter what, I'm an addict for life now.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't go back. But what I can do is I can remember the good things about today in my sobriety, and I can add them to tomorrow's good things and the next days and the next days. And hopefully by the time I get to the end of this, I have enough good things piled up that the bad things, the drugs, the desire to use is so much smaller than the good things,
mm-hmm.
that I can just be happy with my everyday, the same boring life.
Boring life is the beautiful life.
It is, except sometimes it's boring.
It's okay.
But I mean, that's the point I want my people to get from my story, is that it's not unique. It's the story that brought me to this moment in my life. It's a story that I feel is worth telling, because I feel if I can help this one person understand that it's okay. It's okay that you're hurt. It's okay that you feel alone. It's okay that you're depressed. But there are other options. You don't have to put that needle in your arm anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to do it. You don't have to take the first. Now, there are people out there who want to help you be better. And we may have run into people who said they cared and they didn't care and they left. Try again, because there are people who truly, truly, truly want to see you be better. And if you are suffering with substance use disorder and you don't know where to start, start at an NA meeting or an AA meeting.
Yes.
Start there. Go into the room. Listen, I still think it's a cult, but I go and I sit there and I listen to people talk, because there, you never know who is going to connect with you that night. You never know whose story is going to resonate with you or help you.
Absolutely.
And just start with a meeting and just put the drug down. Just put it down. No good solutions come from the end of that needle.
No. Or that pill bottle.
Or the pill bottle, or at the end of that bottle, you know, a vodka, or there's no answers in those. And we've all searched for the answers and we keep finding nothing. So let's stop searching for the answers there and let's look somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. I think that's awesome what you had to say. I think your story is inspiring. I think that there's so many stories to hear in the rooms of AA and NA, and even in, you know, dual diagnosis, recovery is anonymous, then in refuge recovery. There are people in recovery maintenance programs all over the world that use those as an outlet to create their own recovery. It doesn't necessarily have to be exactly what's written in the big book of AA or NA or how people say. If you take it and you make it valid and relevant to you, your recovery will be obtainable.
Right. And I'll say too, like at my first NA meeting, I was like, oh, I do not prescribe to this bullshit at all.
Right. But
it's because I went in, you know, I was always kind of a religious person. You know, I have my belief systems, but like, I didn't like the idea. I thought it was they were trying to like shove God down my throat. Or if you take the program for its core belief system of the 12 steps or for the core belief system of just like, we're here if you need us. I always say that, you know, it's easy to relapse because you know the party's always going to be happening, but it's also easy to stay sober because you know that meeting's always going to be happening.
Yep. No matter where you are in the world, it's happening.
And let me tell you what, those three old hats that were there your first day will probably still be there your 734th day.
Because
it works. And you can see that through the elders of the group and their commitment. There are also podcasts like this one out there that give people the platform to tell their stories. So that being said, if any of our listeners out there are suffering with substance use disorder or have gone through their own treatment and are looking to tell their story, please contact us. We would love to hear it. Our listeners would love to hear it. And it doesn't matter if you're a drug addict, an alcoholic, or an addict of any kind, really. Even those family members out there who have maybe lost a loved one from addiction or substance use, and you want to tell your story, I think we need to hear everybody. I think we need to hear all sides of it because I feel like this is a bigger pandemic than the actual pandemic happening right now. And we kind of have brushed it under the rug. I feel like lately, though, it's starting to come to light more about addiction and recovery and how we need to be a more open and affirming society and helping those who suffer.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening to Diary of a Former Addict. I have been your host, Alan.
And I'm your host, Annie.
And we thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget to check out our website, www.diaryofaformeraddict.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at Diary of a Former Addict. So we'll see you next time. Good night.
Bye-bye.